Thanks, Adam. Really, thanks for that introduction. Mark, I'm really pleased to be here. And as Mark pointed out, it makes my job to keep everyone lively and engaged for at the end of the day. Fortunately, we have four people here who definitely can do that, as we've seen. And I think we'll follow the same procedure as we did last time, with one exception, and that is I'll take the chair's prerogative of asking the first question, because I have two chairs of the nuclear, former chairs of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and after listening to Ward Sproat again tell us this morning that the department is going to submit a license application this year, I just can't resist asking these two former chairs what their impression is as how the NRC will view the license application when it's delivered.
Dick, you go first. You go first.
Well, the question is, as you heard it, and let me say, I do not know how the NRC will respond. It does seem to me that there is a legal problem that the NRC will promptly confront. That is that the standards by which it has to judge the application by EPA will not have been promulgated, and the NRC's own standards will not have been promulgated by then. Perhaps we don't know what the schedule is. It does seem to me that there is a problem for the NRC in doing an acceptance review of the application as to whether it adequately covers the material that needs to be encompassed within the licensing process when you don't know the ground rules by which, at least in a formal sense, you don't know the ground rules by which you're going to judge the application. And it could well be that they thought their way through this problem in its face. That would seem to be quite a difficulty for the NRC in deciding whether it has an acceptable application for it that it can make in that process. Now, the expectation is that I'm sure that the final application will be basically how you deal with 10,000 years with some supplement to deal with the remainder of the period, but exactly how you're going to have to judge that is not as a formal matter resolved until the standards are called.
So, the NRC basically got out of the business of doing research and development of nuclear waste management. And this is unfortunate, because part of the review process has to be based upon that the staff really understands what they're reviewing. And I think that's going to be the really big challenge. The staff is going to know that this is going to be a review that will be scrutinized in great detail. There will be many more challenges, and at least given the context of the Senate at the moment, one can expect a lot of congressional challenges. So I believe the staff would be trying very hard to go through the license application with great detail, but without, I'm afraid, the intellectual backup, which it would have been nice if they had.
Do I need to use a microphone or
this guy? The podium mic is part of the
podium. Yes, so do we have questions from students or people?
Frank.
Yeah, so Peter, Thomas, Peter, you mentioned earlier be prepared to respond in real time to unexpected events, which from an engineering point of view, that makes sense. From a human behavior point of view, that makes sense. But it's not part of how we're approaching the disposal of nuclear waste. If we were allowed to respond in real time to unexpected events, we wouldn't have to simulate Monte Carlo simulations for a million years. We were allowed to sort of correct things. The uncertainty is still there, but we don't have the flexibility for correction halfway through. So how do you use that is currently implemented?
We
mean, I think there's a number of dimensions to this. Let me just start with an anecdote. The last time I was in Toronto for a meeting with the Canadians had just issued their annual report, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization. And as part of the program, they had decided, in the annual report, which is kind of a vanilla document, not very exciting document, that they were going to show that in addition to the Canadian Shield and granite, that they were going to look in sedimentary clay as well, that they were going to broaden the potential communities who might be interested. And it turns out that sedimentary clay, which is small slices around the size of a big granite pluton, include a number of places like Toronto. And so when I showed up, the headline of the paper, the Toronto Mail and Star, whatever it's called, was, pardon? Globe and Mail, thank you. The Toronto Globe and Mail was, Toronto potential site for nuclear waste. And by the way, they were getting the clips in, and I don't know the Canadian towns very well, but basically every town had the same headline with their own town. You know, put your name here, you know, now. That was a small example of an institutional side of unintended consequences, that they wanted to broaden, make it clear to people that they were not prematurely narrowing down the sites, that they were willing to look at a variety of things. They handled that extremely well. They had a focused set of meetings inside the organization, and in real time went back to all of these various news agencies plus the government agencies and described in very careful detail what was and wasn't different about the program. So on an institutional level, that's just an anecdote of the kinds of things that can occur. Now having said that, I totally agree that when it comes to certain activities, you can't respond in real time, and maybe that's too narrow a definition. Many times, you know, there would be a depth charge over the side from the National Academy, you know, still happens to these days, and you have to be prepared to respond, and you can't respond in real time to those kinds of things, but you do have to prepare yourself for the fact that if somebody is looking, for example, at GNEP, you know, there are likely to be some things coming out of a review that you ought to be prepared to handle as a result of that. So I don't think in the technical stuff, it's again, this be quick but don't hurry kind of mentality. I think you have to be prepared not to be taken aback by things because somebody is suggesting something that is different than what you had planned. And so you have to have mechanisms in place, both in your technical program and in what I'll call your institutional program, be able to come up with a cogent and constant response to how you're going to deal with that.
I want to commit even a step further. 200 years after starting operating Yucca Mountain, you realize that some correction has to be made. And this also, I view it as a response in quote, real time. But right now, this is not in the overall plan. We want complete certainty that we can model it for a million of years without allowing for a correction halfway through.
Let me just give you an example, because I think it relates to this issue about certainty and all, and it also relates to institutional aspects. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the low and intermediate level waste site in El Cabril in Spain, but they have a low and intermediate level waste site there. And they had a lot of trouble 15, 20 years ago with public acceptance. And they had built a nice public information center, and it didn't work. And they had talked to the community about things, and it didn't work. The local community was concerned that this facility was going to have water come through it, and it was going to leak into the groundwater and contaminate the groundwater. And the scientists were saying, well, you really don't understand. That's not how these things work. We've got it under control. And the local community saying, well, we don't trust you. And so I thought that ENRESA, which is the organization responsible, by the way, the French have done something similar to what I'm about to say. Did two very clever things. They went to the local community and said, why don't you we'll pay for it. Why don't you find somebody who you have a lot of trust and confidence in and let them represent you so that we understand all of your concerns and can deal with something? I got them like an EEG, and they went to a retired member of parliament and hired that person to represent them in there. Even more so, they said, you know something? How about if we do the following? How about we're going to put this waste in concrete blocks and we're going to put it in a concrete container, we're going to bury it underground, and we're going to put it in a permeable membrane on, over it. How about if we dig a tunnel underneath this facility so that if indeed water comes through it, which it won't, but if water comes through it, that water will come into this collecting area, will go into a holding pond, will know it leaked, and will be able to contain the waste, and you'll be able to look and see that it's not going to leak. And they did it. They didn't just talk about it. They did it. And I've been in the tunnel. And they directly responded to the concerns of the public about that. Guess what happened? It leaked. Okay? You talk about hubris. I mean, it leaked. They were wrong. And for whatever set of reasons, A, it built confidence in the program, but B, it also demonstrated to people when you run these things, and again, I go back to this question of ologies. You know, I always think about being out in the middle of the desert and having these world-class geologists tell me that this mountain range came from over here 50 million years ago. The other guy, world-class, equally world-class, and now it really uplifted and went this way 75 million years ago. There's a degree of art to these programs. You know, there is. And you have to understand that. So that's not a direct answer to your concern, but I think it raises for me the question of how one thinks about responsibility for responding to incidents that occur in these programs.
Question from a non-aging white
man. I'm going to have a consistent theme over the next 2 days. You guys are going to have to just deal with it. And I'm not going to ask about women in the workforce, but...
You want me to be louder? John heard mission. And we have a workforce. Mentioned the issue of bringing the license application forward to the NRC and having staff with the ability to adequately review and understand it. And I have a question for the people in the audience. How many of you were AEC fellows or had some sort of nuclear training courtesy of the government? Can I see a show of hands? So there's a fair number in the audience. And one of the things that we are concerned about is you all and myself, we're not immortal. And there needs to be a sufficient supply of individuals in the pipelines that can address these questions. And along with the issue of public involvement, along with the technical issues of what kind of barrier, what kind of waste form, is going to get copper, is going to have a titanium drip shield, whatever, is the issue of people with the competence to look at these questions in the future. And I think that the manpower, I can't stick to my crawl, the person power issue needs to be considered. It really does. And I'm biased because I'm from a university and then teach students. So, thoughts?
As you probably know, with the increased interest in nuclear power, nuclear energy departments have been growing.
Engineering,
yes. And as a result, there are more people going into that side of the world. The waste management side, I don't know whether that's yet growing, because that doesn't seem to have the excitement and attraction that electricity generation needs are having. And as I mentioned, I was just part of a study group at the NRC middle of December as they were trying to look at their long-range plan. And there is still the problem that the R&D part of the NRC has shrunk drastically over the years. And the waste management part has almost disappeared. And I think that that is going to come back and really bite the NRC as they're going through this license application. Now, as you in a university know, you can restart programs. You can start training people.
But it takes a number of years before that gets to the point where you've got graduates who really know about this, and then if they're going to go into the government service, it takes them more years to understand this. The conservative pointed out this very complex licensing system. So I think we're facing a problem. And I don't at the moment see much interest anywhere trying to work.
I just want to point a couple of fingers at, or one finger at a lot of people in this room, but we hear from the utilities that, well, you know, we don't really need so many, you know, of the nuclear engineering types or the HPs, and we can train them up with a 6-week course to learn all they need to know, and they'll be good enough and they'll be okay. And I take strong exception to that. And other agencies have somewhat similar attitudes. We really, you know, if we need them, well, we can convert a couple of people with a technical degree to this particular field. And I, again, I strongly question that. And I think you are seeing nuclear programs and health physics programs starting to come up. On the other hand, we still need the cash for research. We still need the cash for students, because the wonderful ones that I've met so far, they don't want to graduate from here with a couple $100,000 in student loans. I don't think they want to do that.
Okay. David and then Tom. David? Oh, can I borrow a microphone?
I think one's for the
podcast. Just as a quick note to Kathy, but several years ago, we did dramatically make it some part of our strategic effort here in the department at Vanderbilt to focus on nuclear waste management, research, and education. So I'm all glad that you're here again. It was thanks to Frank's vision going way back that we embarked on that pathway. But the question that I had for you was, there were a couple of things that I heard as consistent themes throughout your presentations. They included the importance of demonstration facilities, both cold facilities for public view and hot facilities, that to demonstrate that performance assessments actually behave the way that we anticipate that they would, or that we're predicting going forward. A second was an adaptive process that was coupled with monitoring. And the third piece of this that I heard was that defense wastes are different because of the issues of both their nature of the waste, they're not potential future resources, and also because of the nature of their physical form in relatively small quantities compared to the nuclear fuel, spent nuclear fuel. However, they are very important having a disposal pathway because of the restoration of the nuclear complex. So in that context, would you comment on, one, should demonstration facilities and adaptive processes going forward, because Yucca Mountain is on a path and we don't know where that's going to lead, and it's probably going to be some time until that clears out, but for any future efforts or revisions in looking at that, would you call both an adaptive process and demonstration facilities an imperative going forward for public confidence and for technical understanding? And secondly, would you comment on the utility of separating the issues of managing spent nuclear fuel from that of defense-related waste, so that we can get on with the business of dealing with restoring the defense sites?
Start with cost, just the first question, not the defense.
Okay, thank you. On these demonstration facilities, we found them very useful for two reasons. First, we need to demonstrate not really the long-term safety assessment, because you cannot demonstrate that. But what we need to demonstrate is our ability to create what is normally called the initial state in a closed repository, that we are able on an industrial technical scale to do what we are sketching on the paper in terms of bentonite density, thickness of these canisters, no difficulties with the weld and so on and so forth.
animals. So that's a technical part of the demonstration. And the second part, of course, is public communication. It's very much stronger to see things, for instance, from the people who are used to being underground, are very interested to see what we do, but also people who have never been underground. It's a great experience to go there and understand. And to stand just a few meters from the spent fuel is the strongest communication you can do in this business.
I think you know it's harder than I do. And because my argument was that both WIP and the argument was possibly a demonstration for Yakimama was to link it to defense. Now that wasn't linked to what, as we know, trying to get sites cleaned up and closed. That's certainly a major emphasis as part of DOE, and Congress is interested in it. But my sense was that the public was more accepting of a program that's linked to national security. And that's what I thought was a piece of the element that made it successful. And my argument was that perhaps one could demonstrate in the way the demonstration is usually termed, demonstrate that the repository could be made to work just by putting the defense part of the high-level waste into Yucca Mountain, and actually then deciding and saying, and we're going to restart a site examination selection process with all the lessons that have been learned for the commercial spent nuclear fuel. That was good.
Questions. In the one step at a time report at the Academy, which I participated in, we recommended both a demonstration and an R&D alcove. In other words, to make a point that, and the demonstration, I think, in the U.S., we take it for granted somehow that we can do this. The demonstration should be an existence proof, and the existence proof should be that DOE knows how to come and take title to something, come with a adequate transport container, picks it up, puts it on the container, transports it to where it needs to go, offloads it, puts it underground. Spent fuel, for example, is highly radioactive. It's very hot. It's massive in size. It's cumbersome. So the demonstration should be the whole process, in my view, that we indeed have some show me in us that we can do the process in the first place. And so that would be my comment on that. On the adaptive process, I think I probably talked enough about that. I do want to make one question. I think as any this is my personal view, any attempt, for example, to license Yucca Mountain should be licensed for the full perception of what it is that we intend to put in there. That doesn't mean you have to put it all in there right away, but I think this idea, I mean, at one extreme, we've seen people in the utility industry say, oh, let's license it 50 years at a time. Right? I mean, which I think is just an abrogation of the whole concept of what this is. So I believe very strongly that if you're intending to put spent fuel and defense waste in, you have to put it all in. However, as part of adaptive staging, defense waste, by the way, there's a lot of volume. There's not a lot of radioactivity, but there's a lot of volume. So it's not like a small amount of defense waste. But the idea is it is less radioactive, and it's presumably been vitrified. So in some senses, it's a nice stepping stone process in an adaptive staging to start by putting some defense waste in. My inclination personally would probably be to put some spent fuel in as well, but all of this only after a license is received for the full operation of what you intend to do.
Let me just emphasize two aspects of what I think the others have said. One is, I don't think we're going to have a demonstration facility in the sense that it's a facility we're going to demonstrate and then we're going to put waste someplace else. Adaptive, as part of an adaptive process after licensing, what I would see is you put materials in and you monitor it, and it would be sort of a demonstration, but with the idea that you're going to learn it and do the best you can when you put it in, but monitor it and retrieve it if you need be. And we're not talking about something separate from what we hope would be a disposal facility. And particularly with regard to defense waste alone, we have about 7,000 metric tons of that material. We're never, you know, from an economic point of view, it's got to go in the same place with everything else. And since so much of it is vitrified, I don't think all of it is. Some of it's just spent fuel there. It's vitrified. You're never going to do anything else with it other than dispose of it. And so that should go into your disposal facility, whereas in the spent fuel, there may be some other things you do.
Okay, Tom and then John and then Bob. Oh, and over here, I'll get the number from Tom. I think you're first.
Yeah.
Oh, it's way over there.
It's way over there.
We can hear you.
Well, I'll just speak up. I wanted first to respond to
I think it's coming.
Responding to Kathy's comment by noting that Shana Hearn and I are both on the committee, advisory committee to the Office of Nuclear Energy, and supported university research, the Department of Energy and OMB, in their wisdom, zeroed out all of the nuclear energy research, and have now suggested that if any university wants it, they got to get on the GNEP bandwagon. Because it's research money for GNEP, but not for education. But I wanted to ask two questions to each of you, in particular the former commissioners. And I'll know the answer to the first when I hear the answer to the second. But the first question is, do you think Yucca Mountain is safe for disposal of 70,000 tons of spent fuel? And if so, on what technical basis do you rest your opinion? My second question is with respect to high-level waste. The Department of Energy has decided, with the support of Senator Graham, who changed the law to permit this, to put 3 to 5 million curies of cesium from the high-level waste tanks in saltstone and stack it in the savannah of South Carolina. And I wonder if you think that is a safe way to dispose of high-level waste.
Thank you. Second question. I have really examined that, Tom, and I haven't looked at the details of that issue. So I, at the moment, don't have an opinion on it. First, from all the studies that I've examined, and a large number, obviously, being National Academy studies, my answer is yes.
These microphones are a challenge. Not as hard as Yucca Mountain, but it's a challenge. Let me correct you on one factual statement, that it is in fact the case that in the most recent Omnibus Budget Act, that the $15 million for university programs was cut out of the DOE budget, but it was added to the NRC budget. And it was, as I understand it, it was since the DOE did not value this program and on its own, they cut it at least twice, and Congress wasn't going to give them another shot. So there is $15 million for universities that has been sent over to the NRC that is above and beyond what they had otherwise been requesting from the Congress. And they already have a significant increase in budget this year to accommodate the expected growth in licenses. There's an earmarked $15 million for universities, and I don't know what the program is. They've built around that, and I suspect the NRC does not know yet, because this is something that just came out of the Omnibus bill, and I don't think it was anticipated by the NRC. With regard to Yucca Mountain, when I was at the NRC, I would always have answered that question by saying I was going to be a decision maker and I was going to wait all the information to be submitted and I would evaluate it the time that this time that it was appropriate for me to have reached a decision on that matter. My sense from everything I have read is that it is adequately safe. You know, the full story isn't in yet, but based on what I have seen and what the anticipated doses would be, it would be something that I would be comfortable with myself.
And what are the anticipated doses?
Well,
and how do you know what they are since you cannot possibly understand the calculator?
Well, that's a difficult one. I can't possibly understand. I don't know how I should react to that one.
They're on paper. Well, nobody here can understand them because nobody runs the program.
That's not true. There are some of us in the room that understand it.
There are, let me put it this way. I was very careful to say based on what I have read, which is reliance on the sorts of doses that people have predicted that would come from this. I can't claim that I have run those programs myself. This is a site that seems to me that I would be comfortable with. That, you know, but this is the jury is still out and that the process is not run its full course yet. Now, we've talked a little bit about the Savannah River site. I don't know that site in detail. I'm sure that the DOE does not view it as high-level waste they're dealing with there. But I can't comment in detail on that, and you know a lot more about that site than I do, Tom.
I just wanted to indulge me. I read this morning the quote from the 1957 Academy study about disposing of high-level waste in geologic repositories. It was all about just getting rid of strontium and cesium. They've taken the strontium out. I mean, the cesium out. They proposed to take the cesium out of the water and put it in concrete blocks and store it in vaults on the surface of the ground. It's the same cesium, and it's 3 to 5 million curies. I mean, you certainly know what 3 to 5 million curies of cesium. And that's an inappropriate way to dispose of 3 to 5 million curies of cesium.
I think this is a good topic for discussion over our first drink in the John and then Bob, and we have two other people that we want to get through, and we have at least 5 minutes to go.
One of the things that we have talked about, and others of you have alluded to, is the fact that we have not done a very good job with respect to building public confidence in linking the Yucca Mountain project to some of our energy and environmental concerns. I was going to comment on that tomorrow, but since some of you did today, I thought I would bring it up. I think that the context, my big problem with the nuclear waste business is this: usually discussed, talked, analyzed, and addressed out of context. Not in the context of what is really important to our national interests. Nobody's interested in becoming a garbage dump, but we are interested in solving our energy problems and our environmental problems. As a way to increase public confidence, how we you take a step forward in making the connection between the Yucca Mountain project and our environmental and energy concerns, because that's fundamentally what it's all about. Dick, you kind of got to this a little bit in your comments. Maybe I should start with you, but I also think that Sweden has done a much better job of this than maybe anybody else, and so Claus, I'd like maybe your comment on that too, or any other panel member.
Well, think that several of the commenters have dealt with this, some of us in the context of the things that we have failed in adding. I mean, I think that there's, as we see in the Swedish example, and I think to some extent as the Canadian example was described, it's very much a process of engagement through a variety of media that involves not just talking, but listening and engaging and then reacting to what you hear. And I'm not sure that that's something that we have done very well. This, in my mind as well, is clearly an educational component to this, and that is something that involves, again, not lecturing, but listening and responding to what the real concerns are. The climate, I think, for this, the possibilities for this discussion to occur, I think, is changing. And in part because my sense of things is that public attitudes towards nuclear power generally are changing, and will change further as a result of growing concerns over climate change. And having this discussion in a, on a, this isn't some activity that's purely corporate greed driven, something that in fact has some societal benefits for nuclear power, is something that I think the public is going to be increasingly responsive to. And possibility of having a productive conversation in this area, I think, is going to grow over time. And I hope we learn from Sweden and Canada and perhaps some other countries as to how to do it in a way that has this discussion actually engage and get us in the right place.
Perhaps I think that when we started our cycling program at the beginning of the 90s, in a way we had a very good situation, because then the national context in Sweden was that there was a decision to phase out nuclear. And we could argue that this is a decision taken by the democratic system of our country. We have some nuclear waste. It will be limited because in a decade from now we will phase out nuclear. And everybody has to realize we have to handle this waste, and we have to do something with it. And there is a consensus for a ecological disposal. So that was at that time the general context. And then actually facilitated the task a little bit, because even anti-nuclear or nuclear opponents could, many of them, not all, but many of them could adopt to that logic and say, well, of course, if we phase out nuclear, we have to take care of the waste, and we think we could do a good job, and we can run like if we froze. In a way, we're coming now into another context where we will not phase out nuclear, at least not at the pace initially proceeding. Most probably, my personal opinion, we will have a discussion in 5 or 10 years of new nuclear, or at least replacing the old reactors with new ones. And then people who are against nuclear for different reasons, reactor safety or whatever, will not adhere to the nuclear waste program as strongly as before. So that's an interesting problematic in our case, actually. And then I would like to add that one shift we made in the 90s in the communication was to speak about, we spoke before too much about how, you know, canisters, materials, science, of course that's important, but we focused after that on why. And just the fact to say to people, it exists. There's no way around, because the initial reaction was, I don't want this to exist. You know, it's your fault that it exists. It's your problem. But we could say this exists, and you cannot get away from the problem. So that's the context in the Swedish case.
Well, Jim, that's something I've struggled with a lot. I start with something Gilbert White raised several years ago, and it was, there's no case really has been made for why Yucca Mountain is needed. And I think dry casks have made that issue even harder. So the argument of tying it to environmental health and so forth.
Needing it now, we would say. He said needing it now.
Right, needing it now. And therefore, the fact that we have dry casks makes it as we heard from our Exelon representative, makes it painful for the utilities, but nevertheless, the safety and health aspect is, seems to be able to be handled. To then draw the argument that we need Yucca Mountain now, it's a difficult line of reasoning, because basically what it, I think it's currently being said is we need more nuclear power plants, and they are environmentally good. That's going to make more nuclear waste, and so therefore we need Yucca Mountain. That's a logical link that is difficult to make, and I don't think it's been made.
Just wanted to have to add a short one. You only said that nobody wants a nuclear problem. Actually, that's not true in our case. That's very interesting. I mean, the mindset of the large majority in these two municipalities, public, elected people and so on, is that they are part with an advanced environmental protection program with the, you know, running in the front line, and they're simply proud of being part of that, and they're stimulating and so on. So they have a different perception of what's it, it's all about. And the regional council for one of these regions has a 10-point list of their regional development program. One of these points is we take responsibility for the nuclear waste in our country. So that's you know, the perception they created over the last 15 years.
So if we're going to squeeze in several more questions, we're going to have to go to shorter answers and shorter questions.
So my short answer is that I believe at any point in time, the cheapest and easiest thing to do with regard to nuclear waste is essentially nothing. So that rationale for why we're doing it doesn't naturally flow from the fact that we need to do this in that sense. I think the reason we need to do this is pretty straightforward. It's the right thing to do. We're creating the waste. We're the ones who are benefiting from the nuclear power. And we have an obligation to make the best efforts possible to provide a solution. Doesn't mean necessarily it has to be implemented as fast and as fully as possible, as I've explained, but we have an obligation in my mind to do it. And that's the driving force in all of these cases, because people recognize that if we don't do that, we leave it to future generations to handle. And there's no reason, in my view, to suspect that somehow acceptability is going to get easier in the future and somehow they're going to be happy that we left them this issue.
But you just made the connection because you used the word benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let me just say, I think there's a second growing reason for this, and I alluded to it at the end of my talk. I do believe that in 1953, Eisenhower gave an Adams for Peace speech because he saw a potential growing threat and a possible opportunity, and he painted a vision for a future that handled both the opportunity for the distribution of the peaceful uses of nuclear power and reducing the threats. And the question now is the world changing enough where we need to revisit the bargain? A lot of people would say that there were aspects of Adams for Peace that weren't very good. We distributed, for example, we disseminated processing technology as part of that bargain. Nonetheless, almost every country in the world signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Almost every country in the world allows IAEA inspectors now to come on their sites and verify. It has a huge amount of confidence building in international relations that your neighbor isn't somehow surreptitiously developing a nuclear weapons program. I believe that if you look not at the short term but the midterm and the possible return in a big way to nuclear power and countries wanting to have energy security, look at Japan, just spent $20 billion on a reprocessing plant. Tom would say it's uneconomical, but if you're looking out for the best interests of Japan and you have no natural resources and you're going to rely on nuclear power for decades and generations, they may be willing to pay that price because they know they're going to be competing in a marketplace with China and India and all these other countries for a diminishing, potentially diminishing resource. I believe that if we don't do some, this is my view, you can argue, but my view is an opportunity here to think about the future nuclear regime, and the waste management then becomes a potential piece of the puzzle, a linchpin that builds a nuclear future, that allows countries to have access to nuclear power, allows them to have fuel that they need, They can get that now, but one thing they can't do is dispose of the waste. So we need to start seriously thinking about how we're going to build a regime for the spent fuel that may cross boundaries someday, a tough problem. Can't even dispose of it in this country. But it doesn't leave us in mind of the concept. That's another reason I believe that this program makes sense, because I think it can lead to a safer, more secure, better off world. Sorry.
Bob.
I was going to comment. Is this on? I just wanted to comment about the idea of putting a little bit of waste in and then doing tests. That doesn't make sense to me, and I'm going to explain why. The current regulatory requirements in the regulation require that if Yucca Mountain gets a license, and if the waste is in place, it has to be open and retrievable for a century. And during that century, our grandchildren, or certainly in my case, my great-grandchildren, or their great-grandchildren, are going to figure out whether it's safe enough. But only if they decide to learn from what happened during that 100 years. What's that 100 years for? So that our children and grandchildren, can do experiments, can do analysis, can take data, can think about it, and then can make an informed decision at the time about what they want to do 30 years or 50 years or 100 years from now. But I don't think putting a little bit of waste in the mountain in Washington for 25 years achieves that. Not unless it's a research program that is intended to gain knowledge. Because I can tell you, if I put this bottle on the shelf, it'll be there in a week. And I can tell you that if I put a canister in Yucca Mountain and leave it there for 100 years, it'll be there. Nothing's going to happen to it. For sure. But if you put a lot of waste in a drift, and you study the hydrological changes that happen in the drift, in the water, and in the temperature, and in the changes in the rock, and that sort of thing, that's knowledge. Watching something isn't knowledge. Especially something that you have absolute confidence that it will happen. So it doesn't make any sense to me to put a little bit in watch. What it makes sense to me is to have a considered, rational research program which enables our children to have more scientific and engineering and operational knowledge than we have about how it's going to actually be when you need to. And if that's what we're doing, that 100 years will be well spent, and our 100-year great-grandchildren will have the knowledge to make the decision to close it or not. But putting it in and watching it? I can tell you, watching it, I think I have to. Let me know that already.
Bob, the Swedish program, the commitment they today is about 8,000 tons spent. That's a whole program. So putting 8,000 tons in Yucca Mountain is not just putting something on the shelf and watching.
I agree. We're agreeing. Provided it's a research program, not just watching.
Okay.
I promise this is quick. Speaking of urgency of solutions, Tom, some of your emerging issues were also part of the GMAP program that DOE proposed, which is national security and spent fuel take back in a multinational cooperation for a storage facility. Do you think this is an appropriate time to pursue that type of program, considering that some view we've been through the R&D loop with reprocessing over and over again, such as the Assistant Secretary to the Department of Energy, Dennis Spurgeon, whereas others have expressed that GNAP was too aggressive of a timeline. I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts on that.
Having said that, as soon as that big hand gets to the line, we all have the pumpkins.
Okay. All right. I think that's an excellent.
Give me 2 minutes for an
answer. Yeah. I think that's an excellent question. There are aspects of GNAP that I think are very, very productive that have more to do with the policy implications and the global and the partnership part rather than the nuclear energy part of GNAP, the G and the P part that have been underserved in this regard. And I think the program, first of all, suffers from having changed its position several times, suffers from sort of ambiguity. I'm on a GNAP Science and Engineering Council, overview council. And so when I tell you these, I do it as someone who's participating in reviewing this program. It's very difficult to know what GNAP is at any point in time, and I think it's unfortunate that it was tied to this idea of early commercialization of a reprocessing plant. I don't find a compelling reason for the U.S. to go and build a commercial reprocessing plant at this point in time. The idea that we should be looking to build a coalition where it's not the Habs putting the cabinets under their thumb, but building a relationship where countries who want to can have access to nuclear power at market prices, they can have confidence that they're going to have fresh fuel when they need it, that they're going to have, as part of the bargain, of an agreement that we're only going to have a limited number of enrichment and reprocessing facilities in the world, and probably all of them will be under some kind of international control and maybe even an international ownership, and that the U.S. should lead by example, not by lecturing on these things. It's a very strong and provocative and difficult thing to swallow. I think those aspects, plus the idea of spent fuel return in return for a promise on the part of these other countries not to pursue indigenous enrichment and reprocessing, is the kind of new bargain that I think we may need to go for.
David has a couple of announcements to make.
Okay, first I'd like to thank our panel and our speakers this afternoon, and thank George for facilitating this session. I think this has been a tremendous day. A few logistics right now. The dinner commences at 6:30, and it's a different building from here, and it's at the Student Life Center, which is down the hall, down the road from where we were, about two buildings over from where we had lunch today. And I guess some of us can serve as guides as to how to get there, or if you have maps, if you're going back to your hotel first to get there. It is an easy walk from here. It's maybe the same distance as we went to lunch. Tomorrow morning, we will be reconvening here at 8:30 rather than 8. And that again, it will start with continental breakfast at 8:30, and then we will start the session promptly at 9. So thank you all very much. I look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, and to as lively a set of presentations and discussion.